The gospel reading for today is from the 16th chapter of Luke, verses 19 to 31. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us." He said, "Then, Father, I beg you, send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them." He said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." The word of the Lord.
I have to be honest, lay the cards on the table. I don't have a perfect sermon on this text today. This is a challenging, challenging word from Jesus, and it leaves me disturbed, and probably that is what it's meant to do. Often in sermons, I try and put in a broader context, pull together something by the end, but I don't know if we can do with that with this. This is one that needs us to struggle a little bit. But I do think Jesus outlined the situation well. I think he pointed us in some directions that would not be fruitful to follow, and he pointed us to a path that, while it is ours to struggle on, is the path that we need to take. So let's look at a few different aspects of this challenging, challenging story that Jesus gave to us. First of all, I want to put aside this, the afterlife. I don't think that this story, even though it sets part of the story in the afterlife, is about the afterlife. It's not speculation about heaven and hell and about this great gap. I know it talks about all of that, but that isn't what Jesus seems to be concerned about most of all. You know, we naturally like to think about a story about the afterlife part of this story. It's fascinating to speculate on that, to think about that. But you know what? It pushes off the very real issue that Jesus wanted to address. It gets us off the hook. For Jesus, what mattered was right here and right now. Jesus saw suffering and pain and rejection happening in this world right now, and Jesus needed to address that. So he used the format of this story, but he wants the change to be now. He's getting us to say, if this were to be the future, if this is God's will in the future, then why isn't it happening right now? If it isn't happening right now, what interest are we going to have in making it happen in the future? What did Jesus teach us to pray? Your kingdom come, your will be done. Where? On earth. We're not waiting for heaven. We're here. And when? Right now. A great teacher said there are really only two questions that we need to ask and answer to check the state of our spiritual journey, how our spiritual lives are going. He says those two questions are, where am I and what time is it? And the only two answers are this: where am I? Right here. What time is it? Right now. We so get caught up in arguments over the future, don't we? The most popular type of Christian book all focus on the future, whether it's kind of the Left Behind series. Right now, one of the most popular types of Christian books on sale are those where people die and have some after-death experiences. They go to heaven, they come back with a word for us of encouragement. Those are fascinating, and I can never deny somebody's personal experience. But how many stories did Jesus tell about cute little six-year-olds going to heaven and then coming back with words of assurance for us? Zero. Zip. None. In fact, he says just the opposite. He said, even if someone were to come back from the dead, from back to the other side and talk to us, we still wouldn't listen. What we have is right here and now. So much for speculation about the afterlife, huh? The next thing we need to talk about a little bit in this text is wealth. The Bible never says wealth in itself is bad. Jesus related to poor people. He related to people of great wealth. But the Bible always raises the possibility that wealth has the ability to numb us, to blind us. Wasn't that problem with this rich man in here? Don't you just want to ask, what was wrong with this guy? What was wrong with this guy that there was nothing in here that responded when he walked right past the most basic human need and suffering? What was wrong with him? We all get caught up in that, though. We all want to blind ourselves to suffering just so long as we're happy and in this life, right? This past week, I happened to be at a meeting with Sister Kathleen. She runs Ministry on the Margins. She told that the other week, when it was rainy and cold, one of those rainy and cold days, a woman showed up at her office. She had just been released from jail. When you get released from jail, you only get the clothes that return to you that you had when you were taken into jail. And she was taken to jail direct from the hospital. It was a drug-related thing. She had to detox or something. And so the only thing she had for her feet on that day were those little hospital sock footies that you put on. And they released her on that cold, rainy day with just little socks for her feet. And she said, what am I supposed to do? And they said, well, go down the street and go find the nun. Now, you can't really blame anybody in this situation, but how did we ever get into a case where we had to let that happen to anybody? The second thing I think we need to realize from the Bible about wealth is that wealth will fail us. It cannot endure. It cannot ultimately accomplish what we need and want. Only love endures. This poor rich guy thought that wealth could keep him on the right side of that great divide. He thought it could separate him. But it couldn't, could it? By the way, we're the ones who create that gulf, not necessarily God. We all think, we like that rich man, that we can live separately from others and that we will avoid pain and suffering and poverty in our lives. Pastor Paul, a few months back, had a great way of illustrating this. He said, anytime we draw a line between ourselves and anyone else, anytime, God is always on the other side of that line from us. And that's exactly what this rich man found. You know, it's interesting, even after he dies, even after he sees this situation, he still doesn't want to go and join Lazarus, does he? Because the first thing he says to Abraham isn't, what can I do to get over to that other side and be with Abraham, with Lazarus? No, not at all. Instead, he wants to keep up that old gulf. And what's his first request? He says, send Lazarus, like one of my servants, to get me some water so that I can feel better here. Even seeing what he did, he was not willing to tear down that gulf. The third thing and the hardest thing to look at here is poverty. And when you read the Gospel of Luke, Luke is very clear that we cannot dismiss the poor. Scholars say that God has a preferential option for the poor. In Luke, God is always and only on the side of the poor. And we're so good at not seeing that, so good at not rationalizing why that can't be the case, right? We know every single argument. It gets told to us every single day. Well, the poor don't deserve it because they're lazy or they're on drugs or they won't lift themselves up by their bootstraps. The poor are that way because they don't act right, which means they don't act like us, and therefore they got to do something wrong. The poor are poor because they just want to scam the system. The poor are poor because the system encourages them to be lazy. You know what? All of that could be true. All of it. But in God's eyes, it doesn't make any difference. It could all be true. You know, there isn't a week where a couple times a week somebody comes in the church office and wants to talk to a pastor, and they've all got their stories, and 90% of them you can pretty much figure out that they're just trying to get a free ride. But there's always that 10% that just tugs at your heart, and we try and do what little we can for them. But it doesn't matter, again, as if all that was true. Jesus isn't going to listen to any one of those excuses. Jesus says, I'm going to be on their side. And why are you drawing lines of separation? And if that bothers us, we need to take it up with Jesus. Jesus is on their side. Jesus says, only love is going to endure, not wealth. So live out of love right now. And that is so hard to trust. When we look around us, it sure doesn't look like love is winning the day. But you know, what did Jesus look like on the cross? He looked exactly like Lazarus. There were wounds on his body. He was dying. He was absolutely helpless. All his friends abandoned him, walked right by him, ridiculed him. And when everything else that we human beings think we can count on for our life was stripped away from Jesus, all he had left was to say, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And he fell into his life. 3 days later, he was alive. That's all Lazarus had. All he could say is, Father, into your hands I commend my servant. And he was risen to the life that was always the only life that we can have. So how do we move forward in this? It's so challenging, isn't it? How do we address this? Well, we look at it from a number of ways. Sometimes we look at it and think, well, if we just got people more educated, if we just had a little more knowledge. But Jesus sits there and says, no, you already have the knowledge. What you need is the will to act on it. So what motivates us? What gives us the will? Well, the story, it's really easy. You could say fear could motivate that. And fear is a strong motivator, but I don't think it's a positive motivator. I think the only glimpse that we have, I believe, is that only love is strong enough to motivate us to get outside of ourselves and to go join ourselves in solidarity with everyone else. But how does that love get past our defenses? Well, then I came up with a couple beautiful quotes. One was from Frederick Buechner. He put it this way. He says, I believe there is already within us this image of God. There is something deep within us, in everybody, that gets buried and distorted and confused and corrupted by what happens to us. But it is there as a source of insight and healing and strength. What if that were the deeper reality? What if the love of God is already poured and hidden deep in our heart? And if we let that shine out, if we discover it there, it might transform our lives. The great mystic Thomas Merton put it a little more completely, a little more thoroughly, a little more challengingly, but you can get this. He says, again, at the center of our being is a point of nothingness which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes our lives, and which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God already in us. It is like a pure diamond, blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody, and if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. And then he has to admit, as I do too, I have no program for this scene. It is only given. But the gate of heaven, the path of love, is everywhere, as close as our own heart. Amen.